From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S.-Israeli tensions deepen. Benjamin Netanyahu warns Congress against, quote, a bad deal with Iran.
We must all stand together to stop Iran's march of conquest, subjugation, and terror.
A scathing report on Ferguson. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
This investigation found a community that was deeply polarized, a community where deep distrust and hostility often characterized interactions between police and area residents.
And Hillary Clinton's email controversy. ABC's Jonathan Carl puts it to White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest.
Have you heard of anybody at the senior official at the White House who just uses personal email?
I have not encountered that.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley of Politico, Lisa Desjardin of PBS NewsHour, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? What's your take on Netanyahu's speech, Hillary Clinton's emails, the new revelations on Ferguson? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael Crowley, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me back, Jay.
Also with us from Washington, Lisa Desjardin, political editor for PBS NewsHour. Welcome to you, Lisa. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us as well. Hello, Jack. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane, Michael, and Lisa.
So we'll start with the extraordinary spectacle in Washington this week as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint meeting of Congress. Michael Crowley, put his visit, his speech, into context for us.
Well, essentially, we are closing in on the first of two deadlines for a nuclear agreement with Iran. The first is the end of March for a political framework agreement that will give us the broad strokes. And then June 30th is to get all the details ironed out. And after that, the current arrangement expires and we kind of go back to square one. The administration does not want that to happen. So with this critical March deadline coming up, Netanyahu came to address the Congress to make the case for why he thinks the U.S. and its negotiating partners are on the path to what he described as a very bad deal. And as your listeners will probably know by now, the visit itself was controversial because it was arranged through the Republican House Speaker John Boehner. The Obama administration was not notified, was not happy. The president did not meet with Netanyahu. And what resulted was just an incredible spectacle, almost reminiscent of a State of the Union speech. You know, it seemed to me that Netanyahu, in a way, was playing president for a day. He arrived in the House chamber to much pomp and circumstance, had roaring applause, indeed more applause than President Obama often receives when he addresses the Congress, introduced guests up in the rafters, including Elie Wiesel, of course, the legendary Holocaust survivor and author, all in the service of trying to plead with the U.S. and President Obama not to cut a deal that he says, rather than stopping Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, would pave Iran's path to a nuclear weapon, albeit over a period perhaps of a decade or so. All of this very much infuriated the White House and many Democrats who felt that Netanyahu's expectations are unrealistic, that he is asking us to make the Iranians to agree to conditions that they will never accept, and that, in effect, he's asking us to blow up the talks, walk away. And in that case, in the view of administration officials and many independent experts, I would add, the likelihood is that Iran would accelerate its nuclear program, and we very quickly would be having a very uncomfortable conversation about the prospect of either Israeli or U.S. or joint Israeli and U.S. military action to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon.
Well, here it is in his speech before Congress on Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying that what he called a better deal with Iran was needed.
A better deal that doesn't leave Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure in such a short breakout time. A better deal that keeps the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program in place until Iran's aggression ends. A better deal that won't give Iran an easy path to the bomb. A better deal that Israel and its neighbors may not like, but with which we could live, literally.
Lisa Desjardin from Washington PBS NewsHour. What was your take on the speech this week?
Well, the politics of this, I think Michael covered the policy very well there. And I think the politics of this were impossible to miss. You know, I've never heard Democrats in the House of Representatives have so many negative things to say about an Israeli leader. Now, given it is one group of Democrats who pushed back after this speech, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, many of your listeners may have seen, she said she was moved almost to tears from when she heard the way that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was opposing the president and what he said about the president. Afterwards, House Democrats held, some of them held a news conference in which they not only questioned what the prime minister had said, but they said he outright was misleading people. They fell just short of calling him a liar. These were the strongest words I've ever heard of any politician on Capitol Hill about a sitting Israeli leader. So what we see here is, Netanyahu versus the president has also become an issue within the Democratic Party, as Democrats had to choose literally where they're going to sit. Were they going to go to this speech or were they going to boycott? In the end, it was something over 50 Democrats who boycotted, not a majority of their caucus, but something significant. So I think this has it's a really different moment than we've seen in the politics of Israel at the Capitol, for sure.
So, Jack Beatty, more than 50 Democrats, we know, skipped the speech. Nancy Pelosi called the speech an insult to the United States. A lot of people asking whether that speech was worth the damage it caused to Israeli relations with the United States, Jack.
Yes, those relations, though, are founded more firmly with Congress than they are with the executive, since the pressure is always on Congress in re-election, and since lobbies can have great influence on Congress and less on the president. So probably the relationship is safe in that regard, at least for a while. But, you know, I think one California Democrat, Jared Huffman, spoke for a lot of Americans when he said, "This is a prime minister who's never seen a war. He didn't want our country to fight." Well, he's alluding there partly to the testimony that Mr. Netanyahu, as a private citizen, delivered in 2002 to a House committee where he said the invasion of Iraq would be a, quote, good idea. And he went on to say that certainly Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. That was his track record on Iraq. And now I look at a headline in the today's Financial Times, Netanyahu's only answer is war against Iran. That gets back to the point that Michael made, that if his policy is followed, if we walk away from this deal, and Iran expands its capacities in whatever ways without any international monitoring, the path to a war is almost certain. And it's a grave question whether a foreign leader should come to the American people and say, "You should go to war because our country, not necessarily the United States, is threatened by this by in this case, Iran." I mean, no doubt Israel is threatened by Iran, but even Israeli intelligence people have said over the years, Iran is deterrable. They are not some mad mullah regime, at least in respect to nuclear weapons.
In an interview on Tuesday with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell, Democratic California Senator Dianne Feinstein said that Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech was emotionally powerful, but did not provide a viable alternative for a deal with Iran.
He called it a bad deal, but he didn't say what would be a good deal, and he didn't say what would be an alternative. Is he saying war would be a better deal? Is he saying Israel attacking Iran would be a better deal, that Israel could guarantee that it would put Iran's nuclear possibilities out of the question? No, he didn't say that.
Secretary of State John Kerry said on Wednesday that simply demanding Iran's capitulation is not a way to get a deal with them. What do we know about the deal so far, if anything, Michael Crowley?
We do know some things. I preface this by saying that a mantra from the administration over the last, I guess it's 18 months or so now since these talks began in late 2013, is that nothing is decided until everything is decided. So if you pull one thread from the sweater, the whole thing can unravel. That said, it does appear that we are on track for a deal that would allow Iran something in the range of 6,000 or 7,000 centrifuges, although not highly advanced ones. And the more relevant point here, rather than confusing people with numbers of machines they're not familiar with, is to say that Iran will be allowed a number of centrifuges and allowed to stockpile an amount of nuclear material that would prevent them from being within 1 year of having the highly enriched uranium sufficient to create a nuclear bomb. So rather than focus on the numbers, the equipment, I think actually that's the point I'll stress here, that it's this one-year time frame. And that 1 year is significant because the feeling is, should Iran decide to break out of the agreement, try to race to a bomb, a year gives the international community enough time in the view of administration officials, although Israeli officials think this is not enough time, to respond by applying harsh new sanctions, new diplomatic isolation, and discuss the possibility of a military strike. Another key provision here is that the deal would sunset after approximately a decade. Sometimes you hear 10 years or 15 years. The administration says its minimum is double digits. So the minimum will be a decade, we're told, after which the deal expires. This is not a permanently binding treaty. And at that point, Iran is free to do whatever it wants with its nuclear program, although it is still theoretically bound by its membership in something called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which international monitors watch its nuclear program. It's allowed by the international community to have peaceful nuclear energy, but is not supposed to build an atomic weapon. A key point that Netanyahu made, and I know that Israeli officials have tried to stress this in response to people who say that he didn't offer any new ideas or solutions, is that he said that sunset after a decade shouldn't just happen automatically, but should be tied to Iranian behavior. In other words, don't let the deal end until Iran stops backing terrorism or threatening Israel or other things like that. Administration officials say that's not realistic, but Bibi's camp says that is a new idea he put on the table.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Did Congress do the right thing in funding Homeland Security this week? Should the GOP have held out? What do you make of the DOJ report on the Ferguson police? We're joined this hour by Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour, Michael Crowley of Politico, and by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. A couple of calls to get in here. Jim, first, in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jim. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I am amazed, or maybe not amazed, given our mainstream media, that nobody seems to have brought up the numerous videos available of Netanyahu over the last 20 years saying, testifying that Iran was only 1 year away from a bomb, and also his justification of our invasion of Iraq before we did it, saying that it would stabilize the region and that there was absolute proof that Iraq was close to developing an atomic bomb.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Thanks for that. Here's Charles in Easton, Massachusetts. Hi, Charles. Welcome.
Thank you. I just want to comment. Iran has built a nuclear plant in Syria, which is not part of this deal. They announced about 2 weeks ago they have another nuclear plant northwest of Tehran, which is not part of this deal. So they're already, even though they're supposedly giving into this deal, they already have at least two plants that they're not including in this deal.
So you support Netanyahu. You don't trust Iran on this one. Charles, thank you very much. Let's go to Daryl in Southington, Connecticut. Hi, Daryl. Welcome to you.
Yes. I just have a comment very quickly. I mean,
okay.
We went to Afghanistan and the real goal was Pakistan. Iraq is gone. Syria is gone. There's one more superpower there. Don't we understand that Israel has a goal to go from the River Euphrates to the Nile and that they're trying to weaken everything around it? And are they going to use us to go fight the dirty wars for them? So Obama did not take the bait. I think it's a good move. Netanyahu is a liar.
Daryl, thank you. Let's hear some sound from this week. Speaking in Switzerland on Wednesday, Secretary of State John Kerry stressed the importance of making a deal on Iran's nuclear program.
The first step is to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. And we know that absent a deal, Iran will have the ability to move ahead with its nuclear program. That we know for sure.
And speaking with NBC News on Wednesday, Iran's foreign minister said a nuclear arms deal was close to being worked out.
We are prepared to work around the clock in order to reach an agreement. We believe that we are very close, and we can be very far. But we are very close. If the political decision can be made to get to yes, as President Obama said, but that political decision needs to be made by everybody.
Michael Crowley, do you buy it? We're close?
Well, it's hard to pin down exactly. It seems, I would say my sense of it is that we are within striking distance. We are, it's not like it's secretly known among the negotiators that we're going to get there. We just need a few more days. I think that, you know, it's as though they're building a bridge and they think they have the material to get across the chasm, but they're not sure they're not going to run out or that the bridge isn't going to collapse, if that metaphor is not too strained. In a briefing I was part of with administration officials a week ago, they put the odds at about 50-50 of achieving a deal. President Obama, a couple days later, said that he thought the odds were slightly against getting a deal. Now, you don't know what kind of expectations management might be going on here, but I have also heard similar sentiments from diplomats from other countries. And the big question is this deadline that's looming at the end of March. And by the way, I keep saying the end of March because, you know, typical with these talks and with Washington, there's not even agreement as to what the deadline should be. The administration says it's March 31st to get this political framework that I referred to that would leave the technical details to be ironed out later. Members of Congress say that they're giving the administration until March 24th, and they think that's the day that the administration promised several months ago. But the question is, that date is coming in hard and fast, and the question is whether they can make that date. And if they can't, will Congress, which is set to vote for more sanctions on Iran, hold off any longer? Because the administration says a new round of sanctions could blow up the talks entirely.
And before we move on here, Michael, just briefly, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany all have to sign off on any deal, correct?
That's correct. And the one thing I'll say about that is when administration officials make the case for why they think they can defend a deal, keep Congress at bay, keep Congress from blowing up the deal, they'll say, once you see the whole, you know, this international community, including countries like Russia and China, not exactly our best friends, saying this is a good deal, it's going to be really hard for members of Congress to say all those foreign capitals are completely wrong.
Moving on, the State Department is reviewing Hillary Clinton's use of private email accounts during her 4 years as Secretary of State. The emails from Clinton's account were kept on private servers, shielding them from congressional and Freedom of Information Act requests for at least 18 months after she left office. Lisa, explain why this is such a significant story.
Well, it's significant on two levels. One, there are serious concerns about security. We don't know, what the security parameters were that she set up on her own server. The Clinton kind of camp has said she was careful. These were not any classified matters that she was using on this email. But it's a question. We don't really know the details of that. But I think this is mainly a political story at this point. Until we see what was in these emails, until there's any proof of major wrongdoing or that she was trying to hide something. Right now, it's a political story, and it speaks to kind of this Clinton storyline that the Clintons are generally overly secretive, that they are not transparent. These are the questions that are being raised. Was she trying to hide something? I think when we get into the details here, there are some very important facts to keep in mind, that the actual Federal Records Act that is being brought up here as the thing that Hillary Clinton may have violated, the rules were different when she was Secretary of State than they are now. At that time, the Records Act just encouraged leaders and agencies to use federal equipment and federal and any sort of federally recorded device in order to communicate, because they want all that communication to be preserved for history. But then eventually now the requirements are tougher.
So did she break the State Department rules or not?
The State Department had its own internal rules, and that's what they're reviewing right now. They said that they had told that their policy at the time was that the people should be using official government email. So perhaps she broke State Department rules, but it does not look like she broke the Federal Records Act letter of the law at this point. But the questions are big, are going to transparency and what exactly she was doing.
Here's Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio criticizing Hillary Clinton for using the private email account when she was serving as Secretary of State.
Using a private server outside the government system is extremely vulnerable to hackers and all sorts of foreign countries that can hack in and get secrets. You have the Secretary of State potentially transacting national business on an unsecured server or private server, and that leaves our secrets, and not just that, but our strategies exposed to the Chinese and the Russians and other intelligence agencies.
Jack Beatty, how do you see this? And for Hillary Clinton, does this bring up issues of transparency, of secrecy, and the criticism that somehow the Clintons play by different rules, Jack?
Well, it sure does. I think Frank Bruni put that well in a figure of speech. He said that the Clintons always live on a, quote, knife edge between defiance and self-destruction. Transparency has been an issue for Hillary Clinton throughout her career. We all remember in 1993, I think it was 500 people who, both in the government and outside, who worked on the health care plan that she was devising, and there was a complete blackout on that. No one knew who they were and what the advice they were giving, what the possible conflict of interest were. No one knew anything about that. And then, of course, there was, well, let's not even go into it, Travelgate and all the rest, which in themselves weren't bad scandals, but they showed an instinct to keep everything hidden. And a feeling that revelation was in itself, no matter what the issue was, but in itself something we want to keep buried. And I think it's left some Democrats feeling, gee, do we really want to nominate Hillary Clinton? That's a former chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. He says there's always another shoe to drop with Hillary. Do we really want to nominate her, not knowing what's in those emails? Because he wants Joe Biden. On the other hand, there are people like Paul Begala, the Democratic consultant. He said on a scale of 1 to 10, this is a negative 12. No real voter will base decision on whether, quote, she had a non-archival compliant email server. Mm-hmm. Well, it remains to be seen. What is clear is that the Republicans are going to make every kind of hay on this, and probably for a good while, because this is going to be strung out over some months.
Let's get some listeners here on this. Constantine in Mobile, Alabama. Hi, Constantine. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
So I think it's absurd because there's never been an email sent that can't be found somewhere. And if this was such an unsecure, hackable server, then what's the big deal? Then the information is there. Whatever she sent, whatever emails she has sent, then they can find it. So I'm just curious, is it because they're hiding things, or is it because it's too much in the open and too easily found?
Constantine, thank you. Lisa Desjardins, what do you think?
I think that we just don't know enough right now about exactly how this server operated. And we don't even know if the State Department will release these emails. They have to go through each one, and that's going to take a long time. I think that everyone who's watching this issue should brace themselves for months and months of this story to last, because the State Department will have to go through these emails individually and determine. And I think, speaking to what Jack was saying, this is now the moment where Democrats are remembering what happens with Hillary Clinton. You could say fairly or unfairly to her, that she sort of gets involved in these stories that hover over her, gets these kind of clouds over her that can last for months. Again, fairly or unfairly, I think Democrats are now saying, oh, this is a story that could be with Hillary, certainly through an announcement and much longer.
Let's move to health care for a moment. The U.S. Supreme Court took up Obamacare this week. What's at stake here, Jack?
Oh, my gosh. Well, to put it in perhaps dramatic terms, the New Yorker cites a letter written by the deans of 19 leading schools of public health, who say that if the plaintiffs win this case, quote, nearly 10,000 Americans will die unnecessary deaths each year. Well, that's a pretty big consequence. What they mean, of course, is that they will not get the health care that they now will get, the nearly 8 million people who would lose their coverage if the plaintiffs won. So that is as big a stake as anything in American life can be. It's a matter, as the New Yorker said, of life and death. Nina Totenberg, than whom there's no better expert on this, says don't read tea leaves, and yet people are reading a tea leaf in John Roberts' response.
There's
a thing called the Chevron Doctrine, which alludes to a Supreme Court decision, which basically said that if there's ambiguity in the law, the executive agency with the power can interpret the law. And he asked the government lawyer, Solicitor General, if you're right about Chevron, that would indicate a subsequent administration could change that interpretation, no? And what people are saying about that is the Chief Justice seems to be saying, this is in the political branch. A presidential election can be held on the subject of Obamacare. The next one will be. And that's when the people can decide. So people are looking at that and saying, It sounds like the chief is looking for a way out here.
Lisa, it does appear that Justice Anthony Kennedy's vote is in play, as well as Chief Justice John Roberts on this point.
I think that's right. And I think Jack was right that we have to be careful not reading the tea leaves too much. Everyone's talked about the four words that are in contention here, established by the state, are the subsidies that go along with Obamacare. Can they only go to state exchanges because of those words in the law established by the state?
And could those state exchanges collapse, essentially, right?
That's right. And, there is now on Capitol Hill and outside of Capitol Hill a very large discussion about trying to get some sort of policy in place in case the Supreme Court ends up striking down the way the law works here. But I have to say, there's a lot of concern, very high concern, off and on Capitol Hill, because the truth is that Republicans really have not gotten very far at all, and there's not a lot of indication that they will come up with a very significant plan. Now, others say that it's up to the president to come up with the patch here, but the White House has indicated that they don't see it as their job. They've put this law out there, and if Republicans want to challenge it, they've sort of implied Republicans need to come up with the fix. One other interesting note on this goes beyond our elected officials. There was a meeting of conservatives in Florida over the last weekend called Club for Growth. And that's where they're supposed to be talking about their presidential candidates, which obviously there's like 30 of them that they could be talking about. Plenty of fodder there. But what many of those conservative donors and big influencers were talking about was this case and their concern that perhaps conservatives made a wrong decision here, that perhaps by trying to take down this law, they're going to hurt businesses in a way that is going to be felt across the country. So there's a real moment of questioning this case and also questioning what will happen next if the Supreme Court does not uphold the full entirety of the law.
What do you think, Jack, will happen if that does occur?
If the court upholds the law?
Yes.
Oh, well, if the court upholds the law, we go on. And I think the Chief Justice is right. This is going to be an issue in the 2016 campaign. Probably the Republicans will say, mend it, don't end it. But it's as experts point out, it's very difficult to mend any part of this without changing the whole. But it will undoubtedly be an issue in the election.
This week, the Justice Department called on Ferguson, Missouri, to overhaul its criminal justice system. The DOJ says the city engaged in so many constitutional violations that they could be corrected only by abandoning the entire approach to policing there. The significance of this important judgment, Lisa.
Oh, I think that it can't be underestimated. And I think we're going to see in the next years and months whether this is a turning point, sort of the next phase of how police force and law enforcement in this country works, how it looks at dealing with populations that are incarcerated more, not just African-Americans, but this also goes across class lines. Of course, the report from the Department of Justice dealt specifically with racism, racial emails from the Ferguson Department. There are so many examples, anecdotes in the report that I could go to. And a lot of them have come up before, but one I want to point to is, for example, the Ferguson Police Department arrested a store owner because she got in the way of an arrest. I think there's much more to say on this, but I think this is an important topic that is going to be with us for a while.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, no more elephants under the big top for Ringling Brothers. CEO Kenneth Feld calls it very bittersweet.
The elephants have been on the circus for 145 years, but it's the best thing for our company and most of all for the elephants.
Welcome to the greatest show!
Close call at LaGuardia this week as a plane slides off the runway and skids just inches from the icy water.
He's leaking fuel on the left side of his aircraft heavily.
You said leaking fuel?
A-firm. His wing is ruptured.
And 50 years ago this week, The Sound of Music arrived on the big screen.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years.
You can join the conversation, listeners. Is it the right decision on circus elephants? Are you digging out from snow in the South? We're joined this hour by Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour and Michael Crowley of Politico and by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. I want to stay with Ferguson for just a moment here. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder speaking on Wednesday, saying that the Ferguson community's response to Michael Brown's death can be better understood alongside the findings of a new Department of Justice report on police bias in the Missouri City.
Members of the community may not have been responding only to a single isolated confrontation, but also to a pervasive, corrosive, and deeply unfortunate lack of trust, attributable to numerous constitutional violations by their law enforcement officials, including First Amendment abuses, unreasonable searches and seizures, and excessive and dangerous use of force, exacerbated by severely disproportionate use of these tactics against African Americans.
Several callers want to get in on this as well. Steve from Providence, Rhode Island. He's first. Steve, hi. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Jane, thanks. Here's the question. My impression is on the DOJ, and I'd like your commentators to respond to this. There were two sort of streams. One was to look at the actual episode of Darren Wilson, the police officer, with Michael Brown, and then the other was this larger deal of what's the Ferguson Police Department's track record and so forth. On the former, it seems to me that they came down essentially overall supporting the grand jury finding that Wilson was not to be charged, that, you know, maybe he didn't have to go quite as far as he went, but that he didn't do anything wrong as an officer, and that Brown, for whatever his innocence might be, the notion of hands up, don't shoot, all that sort of stuff, really was a lot of mythology. And so that's my sense of the reading of the DOJ report on that versus, you know, what the grand jury said, and they're essentially saying grand jury was probably right. All that kerfluffle about the grand jury was biased and racist and all that.
All right, Steve, let's take it to Lisa. What do you think?
That caller has a point. There were those two different reports, and the one dealing with Darren Wilson and whether the Justice Department felt that they could indict him on federal civil rights charges. He's right. There were two different points. But I think that it's not exactly an even comparison. The grand jury that met on Ferguson in Missouri, they were at a very initial phase of the process. They had a relatively low standard to move the process forward, and they found that standard wasn't there. The Justice Department was looking at a different federal case. Now, you could say that they did both find that there was not consistent evidence from eyewitnesses. In the Justice Department report, they said that some eyewitnesses changed their story, couldn't testify, and that they had problems with verifying the eyewitness accounts. So Steve does have a point there.
Thank you, Steve, very much. I got to move on here to Iraq, where an offensive to retake Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit appears to have slowed. Michael Crowley, jump back in here. Let's hear some sound first. Testifying on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said that he was concerned about Iran's role in the offensive against ISIS in Tikrit in Iraq, but he hoped it would not turn into a purely sectarian conflict.
Some Sunni tribal leaders in Tikrit, and this is important, have signaled their support for this offensive. And if that's true, it's good news because it suggests that this is not purely a Shia on Sunni thing.
Michael Crowley, help us understand the latest on this front. And what about Iran's involvement here?
Well, what has happened is that the Iraqi government has begun to a counteroffensive against ISIS, which, of course, seized huge amounts of Iraqi territory and major cities north of Baghdad. The second largest city in the country is Mosul. Tikrit is between Baghdad and Mosul. So Tikrit is sort of the first step to taking back Mosul. And there has been talk from the Pentagon that the offensive to retake Mosul is in the works, could be coming this spring, could be coming later. There's been some controversy about the timing and whether there's been too much discussion of the timing. But in any event, the offensive to retake Tikrit is underway. Now, what's interesting about that is that we, the U.S., are very much coordinating this big fight to take back Mosul. We are not part of this campaign on Tikrit. And really the country that is the outside country that's taking the lead here is Iran. So it is a tangled web right now as Obama tries to stare down Iran on its nuclear program. We are engaged in these very complex negotiations, even as Iran has become a critical player in what is the other major foreign policy priority for the administration right now, which is this fight against ISIS, protecting America from terrorism and also trying to hold Iraq together and keep the region stable. You know, the upside of this is that the Iranians can provide a lot of assistance. They have enormous influence among the numerous Shiite militia fighters, largely based in Baghdad, who we are seeing as part of this offensive. The downside is that, as Secretary Carter mentioned, Iraqi Sunnis are suspicious of Iranian influence. The Sunnis and the Shiites are in the middle of a terrible sectarian war, and this could go terribly wrong if it seems to be a Sunni on Shiite battle. And I think the other key point to make here is it will be very frustrating and disappointing for the U.S. if this offensive fails. I think that the hope was that the Iraqi government wouldn't really mount a big counterattack until it was completely ready, its troops were trained up, the plans were well laid and coordinated, and they would go in with overwhelming force and get it done to break ISIS's momentum, ISIS's sense of sort of invincibility and inevitability, and to really come in, put them on the run, humiliate them, and to send the message that ISIS is not as big a giant as it makes itself out to be. So I think there's a lot of trepidation about whether this offensive will succeed, and it's playing out right now, and I think a lot of fingers are crossed in Washington.
And the U.S. has conspicuously avoided launching airstrikes in support of this latest offensive, Jack Beatty.
Yes, that's part of the hands off. There's some kind of coordination, I think, through the Iraqis to the Iranians. But you know, Vali Nasser today, the former special advisor to Obama, puts it this way: U.S. strategy in Iraq has been successful so far, largely because of Iran. It's important to step back and see there is the folly of our war of eliminating Saddam Hussein. What we have done is empowered Iran. I mean, Iran is in Iraq because of our intervention, and it is a kind of it's a reductio ad absurdum of where our policy over the last decade has led.
Let's hear from Troy in Iowa City, Iowa, on this point. Troy, welcome to On Point.
Yes, how are you going to beat or negotiate with Iran when you can't even beat ISIS in Iraq? And the other thing is, it isn't Bush's fault, it's Jimmy Carter's fault, because he let the Ayatollah take control over one of our Western powers over in Iraq.
All right, Troy, thank you. Michael Crowley, I'll send it back to you for Troy's first point. If the U.S. and Obama can't beat ISIS, how are we going to negotiate with Iran?
Well, you know, there's a school of thought that negotiating with Iran makes it easier to beat ISIS because there is this kind of, you know, tacit, kind of under the table, semi coordination. I guess the administration insists it's not coordination, but this kind of, you know, wink nudge, parallel fight against ISIS, and that the, you know, the more we have cordial relations with Iran, the more we can cooperate against this threat. Now, Bibi Netanyahu and a lot of conservatives, and not just conservatives, say it's crazy. You can never have a real partnership with Iran. It's a fanatical regime. But there is a school of thought that says there's some value to that. And briefly on the other point, it is just an interesting reminder that, you know, there was a time when Iran was America's key ally in the Middle East. Before the Islamic Revolution, the Shah was kind of our guy in the region. So there is precedent for good relations between Washington and Tehran and cooperation. I do think we're very far from outright cooperation and friendship.
Just a few minutes left here. I want to move to Moscow for a moment. Big week there. Speaking to CNN at the funeral of Boris Nemtsov on Tuesday, here's a Russian opposition activist condemning that killing.
This is a terrible crime. This is a political terroristic attack, which have no explanations and have no excuse. This is the attempt to destroy all the people who thinks differently from Kremlin.
Michael Crowley, tens of thousands of people from a broad spectrum of political parties and movements turned out in central Moscow to pay tribute to this opposition leader who was shot dead near Red Square. Do you think this shooting might galvanize the Russian opposition?
Well, it might. But I have to say the balance of the evidence and expert opinion that I've heard and seen is that it may very well not. And there are a few reasons for that. One is that the Russian opposition for some time now has been very splintered, fractious, disorganized. So there may be decent numbers of people who represent the opposition, but they sort of don't have it together in a fundamental way that really creates a critical mass. Now, you know, in their defense, they are also facing an incredibly repressive regime. Russian media has grown increasingly censored, propagandistic, sort of chauvinistic, and there's just very little room for dissent in the country. And I think people are scared. This really looks like a political assassination. And maybe you could say, well, you know, very strange coincidence has happened. Perhaps it was random. Perhaps it was some personal feud, as some people have suggested. Except when you step back and you look at the last decade or so, you see this pattern of Putin critics who somehow wind up with bullets in their bodies. And I think that people feel like they are really risking their lives. The final point to be made is that although there are Russia experts who say that the polls showing that Vladimir Putin's popularity is sky high, particularly after this intervention in Ukraine, although there are people who say those numbers are inflated, I think in general people agree that Putin basically has the public behind him and that the opposition is a minority and that they really have an uphill battle. So it's possible, but I just wouldn't bet on a new Russian revolution being around the corner.
Michael Crowley, thank you. Let me go back to Washington to wrap this hour up here, because House Speaker John Boehner surrendered to Democratic demands this week to fully fund the Department of Homeland Security, which averted a department shutdown. Lisa, how did you view the latest showdown here in Washington on this?
Oh, Jane, it was a gripping, gripping weekend in Washington. Yeah. You know, I had all my friends Friday night just stop everything they were doing to turn on C-SPAN. You know, what I think what we're left with here, we Homeland Security was funded, will be funded to the end of the fiscal year, which is what Democrats wanted all along. I think the fallout here is, to be honest, from my point of view, I think Boehner's position is exactly the same as it was, which is he has a conference of Republicans, which he cannot necessarily get a majority of on any of these major must-pass legislations. And there are more crises like this ahead, potentially with the debt ceiling later on in the year, but coming up more closely with how Medicare doctors are paid, right, and also the Highway Trust Fund. So I think if you look at the numbers here, you see House Republicans are split into three caucuses. I call one the No Way Caucus. I call the other the Another Day Caucus. Let's fight another day. And then in the middle is sort of everybody else that isn't sure exactly what to do. Also, one political note here is Republicans came into power this year when they took over the Senate saying, finally, you know, we can show what we can do, we can govern, and if we pass things that get blocked in the Senate, we will show that it is Democrats' fault, that they are blocking us in the Senate. Well, they can't do that with this. This was all problem within the House, within House Republicans, who have one of the largest majorities that they've seen in years.
Jack Beatty, Speaker Boehner did not gain any concessions on immigration. He wasn't able to control unruly members of his caucus. Any fallout for him, to your mind?
Well, people say it's very rare once a speaker has been installed to have him be removed, although you have heard rumblings of that. But, you know, the speaker wears two hats. He's the party leader, but he's also the leader of the institution. And he governed as an institutionalist in suspending what he called the Hastert rule, named after Dennis Hastert, the former Republican speaker. And basically that is, we will only put a bill up if a majority of the majority is for it. He put aside the Hastert rule, as he has done on some other occasions, and just put the clean bill on the floor, and with a big majority of Democrats and a good number of Republicans, it passed. So did, to many people's surprise, Amtrak funding. Well, it shows, you know, government can work. And in point of fact, if he were to put the Senate immigration bill of a couple of years ago on the floor, some people think that would pass, too.
Well, as Lisa say, we've got Medicare reimbursements coming up, federal highway programs expire in May, budget resolution this spring, right? So stay tuned, more to come. Thank you very much all for a really insightful hour. Lisa Desjardins from Political Editor from PBS NewsHour. Really appreciate it, Lisa. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Michael Crowley, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Political. Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jane.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, Tikrit, Mosul, the U.S., Iran, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, and more joined forces in Iraq. We'll look at all of that coming up on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson for now, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.